And we're live. Welcome to the first episode of Worldwide Wednesday, an original podcast. My name is Shiny.
All right, and I'm Sovereign.
And today is our pilot episode. It'll be the first episode of hopefully many that we plan to produce. The podcast is going to be about many different things, like video games, TV shows, anime, and politics. So there should be a little bit of everything for everyone. Sovereign, do you want to tell us what today's topics are?
So we're going through a lot of stuff today. So first up on the docket, the newest Smash character that just got revealed to us over this week. We also have a full in-depth look at the newest What If episode and this season as a whole. What other things we've got to talk about is two particular corrupt politicians that have been very prominent in the news for the past few months and have come to a head this week, and also the release of the Pandora Papers and the implications that has.
So, sit down, get something to drink, because we're going to just get right into it, starting with Smash. So, yesterday was the final Nintendo Direct for Super Smash Bros. Ultimate. And they revealed as the final character for DLC Pack 11, it's Sora from Kingdom Hearts. What do you think about that?
Going into it, I was actually not hoping it was going to be Sora. But seeing how they implemented his traits into Smash as a whole, I think a lot of people are going to be happy.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I didn't really have many expectations going into it. I kind of just told myself, well, whatever happens, happens. And I was genuinely surprised when they put Sora in the game. I mean, for me personally, I thought Disney would never agree to this. I mean, it's Disney. Disney, the most stingy, corrupt company on the face of the earth, let Sora into Smash Brothers.
Hey. We have to talk good about Disney in about 15 minutes here. Let's not get too carried away.
Okay, fine. We'll save that for later. Anyways, but overall, I was really satisfied. I think the production of the Direct overall just gave a sense of finality to not just the DLC, but I think to Smash as a whole for the next couple years, because just everything about it just gave a sense that this was like the biggest thing for Smash up to this point, and maybe for the foreseeable future. I mean, it just felt like one giant goodbye with a great character.
Now, the real thing that's buzzing in, I'm sure, a lot of people's mind is how long of a vacation is Sakurai going to get? And is he even going to make a next project?
If anything, he definitely deserves a long vacation. The man has been working himself for, I don't know, since like 2014? No, not 2014. I would say around 2016, probably, when Ultimate went into pre-development or something along those lines. He definitely needs a long break. And if anything, I think his next project will probably be another Kid Icarus title or maybe something new entirely. I don't think he'll be touching Smash for at least maybe 3 to 4 years.
Yeah.
If even that long.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. But the inclusion of this character is definitely groundbreaking, because, I mean, they even made a point to it saying Sora is finally here.
Yeah, I mean, people have wanted Sora in Smash since the first Kingdom Hearts game and the first Monster Melee, pretty much. I mean, I remember even back in Brawl, people were thinking about Sora coming to Smash, and then most definitely in Smash 4 after they announced DLC, and then all throughout Ultimate, and now finally at the very end he's in, and honestly, he's a lot more grounded not in the literal sense, but like a lot more of a grounded character than I guess I expected him to be, since he's such a fantastical character from like what is basically Disney meets Final Fantasy. I kind of expected this just like over the top, just completely just balls to the wall type character, but in reality he's actually fairly simple.
So you're talking in aspects like Kazuya and Steve are pretty like original like characters. They got their own unique mechanics, and they're pretty weird when it comes to like the traditions of controlling characters in Smash. But I can see what you're saying.
Yeah, definitely.
That.
Just from looking at the Kingdom Hearts game, because I've never played them, but I've seen the trailers and I've seen, like, specifically the boss fights. I've watched my friends do various different Kingdom Hearts boss fights. I thought, oh my god, if this character ever came to Smash, it would be. This character would just need so much, but really, it seems like they nailed him down in a pretty simplistic way, and many Kingdom Hearts fans seem to be, at least from what I've seen, pretty satisfied with how his moveset and his entire kit has come out, and they feel it's pretty faithful to what he's like. I mean, from the three-hit combo to the magic to what's it called? The down B, his counter.
Right.
Yeah, and especially the costumes. The costumes and Hollow Bastion, the stage, everyone seems to find like the most faithful.
Right. Now, how many times have you rewatched that trailer? Because I've rewatched it like 5 times.
I think I've watched it like 3 times, and it was just.
The build up to that was really long. Like they really took you for a ride throughout that whole trailer.
Yeah.
Especially with the callback to the first reveal of Inkling back in, when was that, 2018?
I think it was 2017.
Definitely a while.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It was the main thing I liked about the trailer, specifically the one that they showed at the end, which was the full, was the mini Sora versus Sephiroth fight, because I know for a Kingdom Hearts fan, that fight is one, I think it's a hidden boss fight, and two, it is probably one of the hardest boss fights in that franchise. And I mean, one would expect it. It's Sephiroth. Like, he's the pinnacle of video game antagonism. Like alongside like Bowser, Dr. Eggman, and like Ganondorf
Right.
and Dr. Wily.
So of both fighters' passes, do you think that this was the right one to end on?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely think this was the best one to end on because I mean it's pure wish fulfillment. Like the very end was like, this is what we think everyone would love. It's probably the best way to go out, leaving just everyone slack-jawed, and I think they nailed it. What do you
Right.
think?
Like the only characters that come even close to that level of hype that we got as a response was would be either Steve or Sephiroth. Sephiroth probably coming closest of all of them. I think that this was the right one to end on because we got many first party reps. You got Byleth, you got Min Min, you got some out there choices like Terry, Kazuya, and Steve. But yeah, I think this was the right one to end on for sure.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, but of the 12 DLC characters from Piranha Plant to Sora, which one was your favorite and which one was your least favorite?
See here, out of all of them, Well, my favorite out of all of them, honestly, I'm going to say Steve.
Steve?
That's the one I have personally been wishing for this whole time. And when I saw that the first 10 seconds of that trailer, I was like, yeah. Or not the trailer, but right when Mario gets blown away in the trailer,
Yeah,
you could tell immediately.
when Sonic literally punched him to Minecraft.
But my least favorite, oh, that's kind of tough. I mean, the easy answer would be Piranha Plant, but he's still fun to use. If I had to choose a least favorite out of all of them, honestly, I might go Banjo.
Banjo?
He's the less unique and overpowered of the cast.
Yeah.
I would say he's the least fun to use out of all of them.
Interesting. For me, my favorite out of all of them to play, I think is, well, obviously barring Sora, because he's not out yet, but for me personally, my favorite one revealed was probably, let me think about that. The best reveal was definitely Sephiroth, in my opinion.
For sure.
Was definitely Sephiroth. The worst reveal, I think, in my opinion, was I think it was Terry, just because some intern screwed up and accidentally leaked some Fatal Fury song on YouTube and completely ruined the surprise. But I think in terms of reveal, Terry just had it worse just because he was leaked probably like a day or two before. But in terms of characters that I had fun and least fun playing, the least fun for me was probably Hero.
Really?
I don't know. Like, I liked Hero when he first came out, but then compared to like Piranha Plant, Joker, Banjo, Terry, and Byleth, I found Hero just to be the weakest one in terms of fun for me to play as, and this was especially accentuated throughout Season Pass 2, where I felt that Min Min, Steve, Pyra, Mithra, Sephiroth, Kazuya, I felt they were all on some level very fun to play. And moving on from that, I would say the most fun for me is definitely Kazuya. Just the way he just plays, I just find extremely gratifying. Just the heavy hits, the sort of stiff movement, but still just kind of moves just very fluidly. I just like. The only problem I have with him is sometimes he's just facing the wrong direction when I want him to turn around. And I think that's just a problem with all the fighting game characters with an auto turnaround. But outside of that, I just find him very fun to play. And let's be honest here, if you spike with his down smash, it's the most rewarding thing ever just for how brutal it is. Especially because his attacks don't have hit stun. Like, your character doesn't go into hit stun, like, because it's based off of Tekken. So when your character gets hit by that down smash, you just die off stage. Like, your character disappears.
Yeah, you make me well aware of that for sure.
Yeah, I do. It was... Overall, I do think Kazuya is the most fun, but Sora does look like he could be very fun, because jumping through the air like that and comboing, especially with his...
I mean, he's pretty much a reverse Little Mac, but he'll probably be good.
Yeah. If Sora somehow is bottom tier, I would be very surprised. Because that would mean he'd be worse than characters like Dr. Mario and Ganondorf, which I could not ever see happening. I mean, yes, Ganondorf in the 1v1 probably kills him at like 20%, but still.
Right.
I definitely think Sora's going to be a good character. Just for the fact that his costumes are amazing. I think my favorite costume is the Kingdom Hearts 3 and then the Timeless River one.
Yeah, which really hoped that they gave that treatment for costumes for this entire game, but we'll see. Maybe next game.
Yeah, that's the biggest thing. I felt that like the main cast of Smash really did get screwed on some of the costumes. Like, why isn't there a Dry Bowser? Like, Bowser, for example, could have so many good costumes. Like, he has Dry Bowser.
Or even ones that have come out in the past half decade.
True.
Like you got Meowser, you got Wedding Bowser.
You have Rookie from Superstar Saga, Dry Bowser. You have Dark Bowser from Bowser's Inside Story. Like, you have enough unique. Or say someone like, let me think, another person that's not a Mario character but has good costumes. I would say Ryu could definitely have worked. Like, you could have given him Evil Ryu, you could have given him Dan, you could have given him Akuma, you could have given him Fang, which is basically like Evil Ryu 2 Electric Boogaloo, where he's basically just become an overdesigned demon, but still, it could have worked, especially because Fang came out in between Smash 4 and Smash Ultimate. Like, you definitely could have put him in as an alt costume. At least Evil Ryu and Violent Ken. They're literally just gray recolors. They could have easily put them in.
Right. But, so, as far as fulfilling Sora's slot, do you think any other character would have been just as hype to fill that last slot?
Well, considering Dante was... Assuming Dante wasn't deconfirmed as a Mii fighter or Doom guy, I feel like the only three that could have worked were Dante, Doom Guy, or Master Chief.
Yeah. A lot of people wanted Master Chief for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I love Crash and I love Spyro, and they're definitely gaming icons, but I feel like the idea of... I mean, I feel like Dante would be on the level of Crash and Spyro, so maybe take him out, but, like, Doomguy and Master Chief. I mean, Doomguy, the father of the first-person shooter genre. Like, he is the father. He defined the genre for generations on end, and his game, his games, plural, are always amazing. And then Master Chief, who is the mascot of FPS alongside Call of Duty. The Call of Duty doesn't have, like, a single character
not,
that one
not
points
even just
to.
FPS is just Xbox in general. Like, yeah, he's... Does Microsoft have any other reps besides like Steve that represent their company?
I would say it's Master Chief. It's Master Chief. Halo is an amazing franchise. I mean, I love Halo 3. I played it a lot as a kid. It was such a fun game. Even Halo ODST was fun for me. I really liked it. And Master Chief just... I feel like everyone loves Master Chief. Like, I don't think you'll find a single gamer that thinks Master Chief is bad. Because he's just a badass. And I feel like if he showed up in Smash, he would be a heavier Snake that is as aggressive as, like... Well, I don't know. Who's a very aggressive character? Like Pikachu or something. Maybe not as mobile as Pikachu, but, like, he would be so aggressive, so heavy, and I think people would just love it because it's Master Chief. You can't go wrong.
I think that was a very successful first segment. What was that, 17 minutes?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. We're making good time, but overall, I feel that Sora was a good reveal. I feel that the entire production for that entire direct was perfect. Sakurai clearly had fun with it to the point where he's like, who am I even talking to when I say these things? Am I talking to you? Am I talking to myself? Why do I even say the things that I do? I feel like he was having a lot of fun, and overall, I thought it was a good direct. One last thing. What did you think of the amiibos that they showed off?
I'm buying all of them. I haven't bought any of them since Ultimate came out. I'm buying them.
You're going to buy all the DLC ones?
They look so nice. Like
they do.
The past five that have come out, and only just those ones.
Yeah.
Because the last one I bought might have been at the tail end of Smash 4.
Really? Which one was that?
It had to be King Dedede, I believe.
King Dedede? Oh, wow.
I just bought that one because I thought it was shiny.
I mean, fair. I definitely want to see a Sora amiibo looks like, but we're probably several months out considering what.
I mean, Sakurai didn't even get the physical versions of Steve.
Exactly. So, yeah. Didn't Steve come out like a year ago at this point?
He was revealed a year ago.
Yeah, so... Yeah, that amiibo is definitely not coming out for a while, but...
And the newest ones are definitely the most detailed, including Steve.
Yeah, which makes sense, because, I mean, they're new. They better be detailed. I mean, how long have amiibos been out? Like, what, 7 years? Like, they better be detailed in the year 2021.
Now, the last thing I want to touch on is the fan reactions to the ending of the Fighter's Pass.
So... After the direct, I looked at r/Smash Brothers, and to my surprise, it was a salt mine.
Really?
Which I thought was kind of surprising, considering, like, I mean, Sora is that guy.
Like, it was the one everyone was asking for. Like, the only other character everyone was asking for was Banjo and Steve.
Yeah. Like, Sora has been wanted in Smash since at least Brawl, and I would think that, like, people in our Smash Brothers would have been, like, cheering and clapping and, you know, having a good time about it, because, I mean, on Twitter, everyone was losing their mind with hype, but people were salty. They were like, I don't really care for this character, or they were outright saying, like, oh, wow, why did we get this character? Like, he's so stupid. And I'm like, over who? Like... Of all characters, Sora is stupid?
Sora's an icon. Like, he's literally a gaming icon. I honestly can't see how he's a stupid choice. I mean, he wasn't my first choice, but even then, like, he's a gaming icon. I don't think anyone could say a slot is wasted on him. Saying a slot is wasted on Sora is like saying a slot was wasted on Cloud, or Ryu, or Pac-Man, or Mega Man. Like, icons. Literal staples of gaming. Like, you go out, you see Sora, you know that's a video game character. You know he's that guy for Disney. He's the Disney video game mascot. I honestly can't see why people would say he's stupid as a choice. I can understand not being excited. I can understand saying that, like, oh, I really wish another character's in, because that's fair, but stupid? Nah.
On the other side of the spectrum, it was actually kind of enlightening to see Thank You Sakurai trending.
Oh god, thank you. I mean, like, right before the direct, fuck Nintendo was trending, and I was like, oh god, here we go again, but I'm really glad that people are happy with him.
That momentarily restored my faith in humanity. Just for a little bit.
Yeah, but then you realize you're on Twitter, and then it goes back. But yeah, no, I think people on Twitter and on YouTube were, and basically the rest of, like, Reddit and just anywhere else, were pretty satisfied with seeing Sora, and think Sakurai did a great job, and I agree. He did do a great job.
Definitely, definitely. Well, I think we should move on to our next topic of the night, yeah, which would be the newest episode of What If.
Okay. So, the new episode of What If dropped this morning, and I did not expect it to go the way that it did, but I was thoroughly gripped by it. What about you?
So, the pacing kind of bugged me a little bit, but other than that, like, it was spectacular.
What about the pacing bugged you?
Like, I mean, it's kind of the same problem with Endgame, where they've got to juggle... I know comparing the two amounts of characters is laughable, but the scope of both stories is kind of comparable here. Just, they had to jam each character in the span of 3 minutes to get the plot going, yeah, in a 25-minute episode.
Yeah, I was surprised they didn't make the episode longer like they did with WandaVision, because WandaVision's ending was, I believe, longer than its average runtime for its episodes, right?
The pacing definitely fixed itself in the latter half because of what transpires throughout the whole episode, and they basically have their little mini, not training arc, but acknowledging or creating the team.
Yeah, but I thought the episode was great. I mean, it pretty much gave up from episode 7, 8, and 9. It gave the fans of Ultron the Age of Ultron they wanted. Because some people felt Age of Ultron, the movie, wasn't as grandiose for Ultron as a villain like he is in the comics. Because in the comics, Ultron is damn near unkillable. Like, he's always around ever since Hank Pym first created him back in, what, like, the 70s or 80s? And, like, Ultron is always a threat. And the storyline Age of Ultron is just massive. I mean, it's a story about Wolverine and Sue Storm going back in time to kill Hank Pym because Ultron took over the world and killed everyone.
Right.
And so seeing a version of that where it's Ultron, he kills everyone and then takes over the multiverse, I think was very fitting, especially because it has the Watcher just basically be as desperate as Wolverine and Sue were in the comics, where it's like, I have to figure a way to stop him. And he goes to Strange Supreme, and then he's like, I have to just find heroes across the multiverse.
Yeah. I will say, I do think that episode 8 was better than episode 9, just marginally.
Marginally?
Just barely edging out. Just because it was building up to something.
Yeah. No, I definitely could see that. It definitely sucks that an episode got cut, which at this point it's all but confirmed that it was the Tony on Sakaar episode, where I think it's going to be in season 2, but do you want me to explain what it's supposed to be?
I would rather keep it vague for now, just in case anyone wants to avoid it.
Yeah, so I'll say minor spoilers for what could potentially be a season 2 of What If episode. But originally, What If was going to be 10 episodes long. But due to the pandemic, things got very, very, very desperate because working from home, chaos, as you all know. And so production for an episode about Tony on Sakaar got cut. And that episode would have followed Tony during the events of the original Avengers, throwing a nuke like he did at the Chitauri, but instead of hitting the Chitauri home ship, it hits the Sanctuary 2, which is Thanos' flagship. And it hits that, and due to it, it causes chaos on Thanos' ship, and Tony gets sent to Sakaar, where he basically does his own version of Ragnarok, where he's on Sakaar, and he meets Gamora, who has her own little adventure that happens because she's on the Sanctuary too at the time, and so she has her own life. And she ends up coming across Tony Stark, and I guess shenanigans ensue, leading up to, I guess, them going to Ninavellir and meeting Eitri, because that's where we see them during this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Overall, like, it's weird to think about Ultron being a much bigger threat than Thanos. I mean, yeah, he used the stones twice and then destroyed them. Here, you get to see the scope of what someone holding the stones for more than a week has the ability to do.
Yeah. There's one thing that people have been, like, very confused about, is that in the comics, Infinity Stones do not work outside of their home universe.
Right.
Bringing them over to another universe doesn't work. This was especially shown during the 2015 Secret Wars event, where after their Infinity Stones were destroyed, when they destroyed another universe from crashing into theirs, they couldn't use another set of Infinity Stones from another universe to do it again.
Though I feel like, just this is a criticism of MCU as a whole, them traveling to different timelines all the time does make that extremely confusing.
It does, for sure, especially because the MCU, while considered separate, is still considered part of the greater Marvel Comics multiverse. It's considered Earth 199999 or something. And it has been acknowledged by the main comic universe. I mean, the Young Avengers, when looking for speed through the multiverse, went to the MCU. And it was also confirmed via Loki's multiversal passport that the Loki of Earth 616 went to the MCU.
Yeah.
And did whatever. It's never acknowledged, but he did it.
Yeah.
So having this, having Doctor Strange's Time Stone working in Ultron's universe was definitely like, that shouldn't work. Or Ultron being able to destroy universes that aren't his own.
Yeah. Because it makes it confusing because they don't make a distinction between a different universe and a different timeline.
Yeah.
For instance, like the stones being brought back in Endgame, and then you have the Loki TV show with it being almost unusable wherever the TVA is.
Yeah.
And then having Ultron punch the Watcher through universes.
Yeah. Definitely.
So like, if you stare at the situation for more than a few minutes, you can distinct, but in the moment, it's very confusing to distinguish between the two, and I hope they rectify it. But at the same time, I think they're trying to move away from the Infinity Stone since they were destroyed in the main timeline.
Yeah, the Infinity Saga is over. We'll see what happens in future titles like No Way Home and What If Season 2 and Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, how they'll handle, oh, and Loki Season 2, how they'll handle Infinity Stones moving forward. But back to the episode itself, I really like the fight scene. I thought it was pretty good, especially because they used Strange Supreme as basically the carry. He carried the entire team. If he's not there, they all die brutally.
I mean, the one thing that the MCU does well is character combinations.
Yeah.
Like, the team-ups are what sell Marvel.
Yeah, it definitely does, and this episode was no different, with Strange having the runes, and then he multiplies Mjolnir to just keep Ultron busy. T'Challa in this in his multiverse, whatever, he's a thief, so he's good at stealing things, so he's able to steal the Soul Stone. I thought was very good. And it also protected him, because as we've been shown throughout the multiverse, normal humans cannot touch Infinity Stones. They die. So T'Challa having the rune allowing him to touch a Soul Stone was just a good little detail to show that, yeah, he's not going to just, you know, disintegrate.
Right, right.
Also, it was really cool just seeing Ultron destroy the galaxy and then Doctor Strange just absorbing it all and then eating it. Which is like, Jesus Christ, how strong are you?
Now you're starting to make me worry about power creep.
Oh, God, power creep. That's, if what is being said about multiverse of madness is true, there will be power creep, and it's insane. Now, this was already insane to begin with, between the Watchers fight with Ultron and what Doctor Strange can do against Ultron.
Right. So overall, do you have a favorite episode?
Okay, so I would say episode 8 was my favorite overall.
Same here.
It was just so good. Between the story that Nat and Clint had, as well as the fight between Ultron and the Watcher, and just the animation of it all, I thought it was great. I thought it was my favorite. What about you?
Honestly, you just repeated everything in my mind. My praise about episode 8, it's the same there. I would say for me, my favorite part was the build-up.
Yeah.
All the build-up to that last scene.
Yeah.
Of the Watcher having to break his oath.
Yeah.
I think that was perfect.
I think it was perfect, too. I think overall, I'd rank the episodes as episode 8 at the top, which is the Age of Ultron episode. Episode 9, Guardians of the Multiverse, is my second. My third favorite, surprisingly so, is Party Thor. That was the one I had the least expectations for, because it's like, what if Thor was a party frat boy? It's like, you mean, what if Thor was himself? But seeing it actually play out like a Looney Tunes episode, I think sold me on it more. Because I'm like, okay, so they're not actually taking themselves seriously with this. Like, this is supposed to be, like, this is hilarious. It's supposed to be comedy. Yeah. Like, yeah, there's a threat the Earth could be destroyed from all these people being on Earth, but, like, it's funny. And I liked it a lot.
I know a lot of people were turned off from that episode because of the bit more goofy tone, but I think it all worked out.
I think it did. I feel more people were turned off by the goofy tone that was in the Marvel Zombies episode.
That one, well, I'll get to how I feel about each episode. You have to keep going on yours.
Yeah, so after Party Thor, I think my next favorite episode would be the murder mystery with Nick Fury trying to find out who's killing all the Avengers candidates.
Right.
I really liked it just because, one, it was kind of neat just seeing the different ways the Avengers would get killed off. Such as, I mean, Tony gets, what did he even do? He, like, jumped into, like, the serum and, like,
he pretty much turned the needle into a gun with himself.
Yeah. That's what he did with Thor dying. He just pushed Hawkeye's hand to shoot him because Thor's depowered. Okay, I guess he just punched his brain.
I think it was his heart, but
I mean, he crawled out of his ear.
Yeah.
So he did that. The Hulk was gory. I think that was probably like the most gory Marvel was went. And then I guess Natasha was something, but she dies. But the fight between Hank and Loki was unexpected, but I really liked it, and I really liked just how Loki had fun playing as Nick Fury, and then he was like, right, so as payment, I want the planet. But I like that. Next, it would probably be, and I know this one's probably not as expected, would probably be the Captain Carter episode, because while it was very formulaic, I thought it was really good. Just, I liked how the story went, because I thought the main story of the first Avenger was good. maybe boring at times. So I really did like how they did Captain Carter. I love the montage scene of her and Steve in the air destroying, like, Nazi airships. I thought that was great. Because, I mean, who doesn't like seeing Nazis get beat up? And so it was just great. And then after Captain Carter, I would say it would be the... I would say it's the T'Challa Star-Lord.
Really? That low?
Yeah, the more I thought about it, the more I kind of just couldn't see myself going back to it. Like, I would go back to, like, Captain Carter or, the murder mystery. And then after T'Challa Star-Lord is the Doctor Strange. Actually, I would put Doctor Strange above T'Challa Star-Lord because seeing that episode was really cool for me, just because I just like the idea of someone just being so grief-stricken that they just destroy everything, and then when they finally get what they want, it's not how it turns out, because it's very realistic in the sense that when you drive yourself to that level of desperation, you really lose sight of who you are, and you become not as monstrous as Strange became, but you become foreign to who you were at the beginning. Yeah. And I really like that.
I guess most of my shock comes from we're only ranking 8 or 9 episodes.
Yeah.
So, and most of these episodes are 7 out of 10s at worst.
Exactly. So then after T'Challa Star-Lord would probably be the Killmonger episode, which it was good. It was just kind of, I don't know, compared to the rest, it was good. It was just not better than the rest. And I will never forgive Michael B. Jordan for his very, very half-assed Wakanda Forever. Like, I cannot forgive it.
I feel like they reused that clip twice.
They did. And it was bad every time. Just the Wakanda Forever! And it's like, no, redo it, please.
That's the take please. You're going with?
Honestly, I feel like they could have redone that take. It was just bad. It was bad, but on top of that, just, it was really just, Killmonger is a gigantic fucking asshole, and that was it. Like, they really didn't do much to, like, show a different shade of why he's an asshole. It's just, yep, my dad was killed by the Wakandans. I hate them, and I think that, we should elevate black people, but not really, because if they disobey me, I'll kill them anyway. And so he kind of didn't really stray from that. I mean, he was willing to sacrifice dozens of his own people to prove a point and become more powerful.
Right.
And then the last episode I'd rank would be the Marvel Zombies one.
Yeah.
It was good, but the quips were kind of bad. Like, in hindsight, the "guys, I have Sharon all over me" after she murdered her was kind of like...
Yeah, I definitely have some opinions about that episode.
It was so definitely cringe.
I understand it was going for, like, the horror comedy parody, but I don't think it landed. Like, I feel like they didn't understand how to make Spider-Man work. Because, I mean, he is a quippy character, but I don't think they did it right. I feel like in order for the whole parody to work, his character needed to be spot on as far as being able to, like, mimic that genre. And if he fell apart, the whole episode fell apart.
Yeah.
Like, if they mastered him and him alone, that would have probably elevated it that much.
I feel the biggest thing that they didn't do that the comics did was that in the comics, the Marvel Zombies speak full sentences. They have all their cognitive functions. They're just consumed by an unending desire to consume flesh and brains. And so I feel like there was so much missed potential for the horror comedy by not having the zombies respond. Like, can you imagine, like, a zombie Captain America describing to Bucky why he wants to eat him. It's like, Bucky, I love you, but I really love how your neck is looking right now. Something like that.
And the furthest they went with that concept was with Happy.
Yeah, where he comes back and he's like, blam. And it's like, yeah, but that, yeah, that's kind of what the point of Marvel Zombies is, and you really missed the point.
And it doesn't even deviate from what the other zombies are doing at that moment anyway.
Yeah. And also just the way Vision acted in that episode was very suspect for me, just because I get they were trying to kind of show that, like Wanda, Vision would also go to, like, very extreme ends to for the one he loves. But at the same time, it's like, this is supposed to be the same character that objected to Wanda stealing the free will of everyone in Westview. And here he is in doing something that, in my opinion, is just as evil, which is luring people with a sense of hope against the zombie apocalypse and then feeding them to his zombie girlfriend, because
I would argue it's worse.
I mean, yeah, honestly, because no one died in Westview, while he's just murdering people. I mean, yeah, he saved Scott Lang as a proof of concept that, oh, I can stop zombies, but, oh, Wanda can't be stopped because she's too powerful. Guess I'll just kill everyone else and not stop the apocalypse. It's like, what the hell? But I've gone on too much. You give your rankings.
Oh, God. I don't even know where else I would deviate. I mean, maybe I would push the Captain Carter episode down, but at the same time, I acknowledge that it's pretty much unnecessary episode one.
Yeah.
I would say it would be my second or third least favorite of the nine, but other than that, and maybe pushing the T'Challa episode up, I would say that mine really doesn't deviate. And the only reason I push it up is just because of the idea of another heist episode.
Yeah.
But instead of with Chris Pratt's Star-Lord, it would be Chadwick Boseman's Star-Lord.
Yeah.
And that's another thing I want to talk about, too, is his last performance as a whole.
Yeah. I think it was great. They definitely didn't utilize him as much in the final episode, but that's fine, considering he had a solid episode of his own.
I mean, he had leading to semi-leading roles in three episodes.
I would say the Killmonger... Well, yeah, even the Killmonger one. He still had a very, like, poignant appearance as well. I would say this was, like, the one where he was least effective.
Honestly, I would actually agree that his best performance was probably the Killmonger episode.
Yeah, because I think that one was, like, T'Challa to his core.
Right.
And it was very just, I don't know, just, they really just had T'Challa and death throughout this, like, entire, like, series. Like, in the T'Challa Star-Lord one, I mean, he convinced Thanos not to genocide the universe.
Which and, I know was a tough pill to swallow for everyone, but I still loved it.
Yeah, I liked it. I would just love to see what he said. I genuinely think it was possible for MCU Thanos to be talked out of his whole thing. Comic Thanos, absolutely not. That guy is crazy in love with death, and he is his own separate brand of crazy, but I feel like MCU Thanos could have been talked down by the right person. And I feel like the only people that could have done it would have been T'Challa or the Ancient One.
Yeah, potentially.
But overall, Chadwick Boseman's performance throughout the series was great.
I agree.
Some people, there are rumors saying that he may have one or two roles in season two that he recorded, but I can only imagine they would be minor.
Yeah.
If that's the case. Like, maybe, like, an ad lib, or, like, T'Challa shows up in some minor capacity, and Chadwick Boseman has, like, maybe, like, a reused line from an earlier, like, take in What If. But I can't imagine that if T'Challa's in season two, it's going to be Chadwick Boseman, like, giving full-on, like, monologues or anything.
Because even at this point, it's still heart-stopping to hear his voice a year and a half after his passing.
Yeah, for sure. But overall, I thought What If was a great series. I would, to be perfectly honest, I rank it as my number one out of the four that's come out so far.
Really?
I would have it go What If, then Loki, then Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and then WandaVision.
Yeah.
Like, in hindsight, looking back on WandaVision, that ending really tanked it. And not because there's no Mephisto. Like, I could live without Mephisto, but the whole just...
It was all build up, and then the ending just really didn't land.
Yeah. I know that the commercials, according to the writers, were supposed to build up to Doctor Strange trying to talk to Wanda and try to, like, tell her that she's, like, she's not herself, but it wasn't that she's not herself. Wanda was in complete control. The Hex and all the terrible things in the Hex were her fault. It wasn't Agatha. Agatha, only thing that she did that's considered truly bad is she killed Sparky. I mean, she killed Sparky, and I mean, yeah, she did hijack Ralph Boner. Fucking hate that, but still. She hijacked Ralph Boner, but I mean, Ralph Boner was already hijacked from Wanda to begin with, so.
Yeah.
It wasn't, I mean, at least he got super speed out of the deal with Agatha.
Yeah. But to switch back to What If. Mm-hmm. Overall, do you think that this would be necessary viewing for the MCU?
I think so.
Do you think so?
I think so, because there are rumors that Hayley Atwell will come back in the Multiverse of Madness as Peggy, as Captain Carter. There's rumors of that, and there's also rumors that Strange Supreme will also show up in What If? Not in What If, in Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. And if that is true, and those two characters are in, I feel like you definitely need to watch What If to at least understand Strange Supreme. I can't imagine Captain Carter would have a massive role.
Okay.
And outside of that, I feel like it's just a necessary reading to better understand the multiverse as a whole.
Yeah, I guess that's fair.
Because, I mean, this is really the multiverse saga between what Wanda's doing with the Darkhold, Shang-Chi, spoilers for Shang-Chi right here, but with Shang-Chi beating the Dweller in Darkness, who's from another universe, then there's Spider-Man No Way Home, where it's looking like characters from across the multiverse are showing up. Loki, I mean, Loki literally is about the multiverse, and now What If? And then moving forward, we're having Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness, another season of What If, another season of Loki, Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, and then there are rumors that the big finale of this saga will be Secret Wars. And if you know anything about Secret Wars, whether it's the original 1980s comic or the 2015 remake, it's all about multiverse.
Yeah.
So I think What If is probably going to end up being required.
And that all leads into what I said a few, like 10 or 15 minutes ago when I said that that MCU just does not distinctively separate their idea of a universe and a timeline. Because, yeah, we're saying multiverse, but we're talking about timelines here mostly.
Yeah, like, it's very distinct, like, when you think of when you think of, like, a universe, you think of, like, the Green Goblin that's in No Way Home, he's coming from the like, Sam Raimi Spider-Man trilogy, which is definitively a different universe.
Right.
Like, there are no Avengers in those movies that are overtly shown. Yeah. Meanwhile, in Loki, I mean, it's kind of timelines. Like, he goes back to Pompeii, and he goes to...
Like, up to this point, in what's been currently shown by Marvel at this point, we have only seen different timelines.
Yeah. I mean, really, yeah, it's different timelines, like...
With maybe an exception being the TVA.
I mean, the TVA is not a timeline. It lives outside of time, so yeah, exactly. That tracks. But, yeah.
Which was the only instance we've seen the Infinity Stones not work.
Yeah. So, I mean, we'll see. Like, my whole opinion, my whole theory about Marvel, about the MCU multiverse is that the sacred timeline is actually multiple universes, which would be the various different offshoot universes we've seen throughout the MCU, quarantined by He Who Remains, and it's all quarantined from the rest of the Marvel multiverse, and thus his version of the TVA is also quarantined from the TVA that exists in the comics, in that with Sylvie, well, spoilers for the end of Loki, but when Sylvie kills He Who Remains, she broke the quarantine. And thus, when she broke the quarantine, it allowed the multiverse to reassimilate the universes of the sacred timeline and allowed for a further crossover, which is how we get the various different alternates that we see in What If, the variants that we're seeing in Spider-Man, and probably what we'll see in Doctor Strange as well. But overall, do you any final thoughts about What If, or just Marvel as a whole right now?
Definitely excited for the direction it's going, but it's definitely been a lot of content that we've had to go through, and especially with the lack of movies we've had over the past 2 years, it's nice to finally get back in the swing of things.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking forward to finally to watching Venom, Let There Be Carnage, seeing Eternals, Spider-Man, and Hawkeye. I mean, those are our last four big Marvel-esque projects this year, and I'm excited to see all four of them. All
right. Well, I guess we should move into our next topic now, which would be our discussion about Senator's mansion and cinema.
Yeah, so
less exciting topic, I know, but it is important.
Yes, politics are important, even though they are infuriating and stupid. So, Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, in my opinion, are the perfect examples of power hungry, in the sense that they have been politically irrelevant for the most part. They weren't making huge headlines until they finally were given an opportunity to get power, which they did get power with the 2020 elections, where the Democrats were able to get a 50% majority in the Senate. And right. Because of that, if you're a Democrat in the Senate that doesn't vote in lockstep with the rest of the party, you have the entire Senate hostage. Because we know the Republicans aren't breaking.
Yeah. They're not breaking. For example, one of the most recognizable moments of Sinema's growth to power is her famous thumbs down for the $15 an hour minimum wage
amount. Yeah, her wine mom, girl boss, gatekeep, gaslight bullshit.
Well, that was her ascent to power, made her a name in the Senate.
Especially because, if you know anything about Kyrsten Sinema, she ran as a progressive in Arizona.
Yeah, like people made sure she was elected because of the things she said on her campaign.
Yeah, she was looking like maybe not a Justice Dem, but at least a Justice Dem affiliate. Like
not a liberal, but
yeah, she was looking like she would be like maybe like a lib close to Sock Dem. But because once she came to power, she's just on her like suburban white wine mom. Like all she cares about is just looking, for lack of a better term, just making money and looking pretty. Like, I mean, have you seen what speaking engagements and what donations she only really does? She only does, like, wineries and, like, expensive, like, fundraisers.
I mean, pretty much her fundraisers in the past, like, month have been out of control.
Yeah, like, it's just for, like, uber-rich people. Like, this is the stuff that we criticized Hillary Clinton for, and here she is doing it. And it's like, do you not understand what we, and by we, I mean people on the left, but also just the general American electorate had a problem with Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was kind of, like, acting like a rich suburban white mom who was just parlaying with all the rich people and didn't seem like she had her ear to the ground about what common Americans are dealing with, especially financially. And Kyrsten Sinema seemed like she's going to be that person, and now she's doing it all over again.
honestly, I don't even... I think this is 100 times worse.
Really?
I mean... because she's so brazen about it and is openly mocking people for thinking the way that they do. Reporters were asking her. Was it reporters or activists? I don't remember.
Oh, but which event are you talking about?
Where she was asked, what do you think of progressives criticizing you for your actions in the Senate? And her response was, oh, I'm in the Senate. Have you seen that clip?
No, I haven't seen that clip. I saw the clip of the student activists.
I'll give you the full rundown of that one. Yeah. So pretty much she was asked that one question, responded snarkily with that comment, and then when they follow up with another question in the same manner, she's like, I'm clearly in front of the elevator right now.
Really?
Yes.
Like that?
Pretty much.
That, oh my god, that is...
Which, I haven't actually looked into it, but I would love to find some sort of recall procedure for Arizona senators, because she needs to go.
Okay, I wouldn't say recall, because recall is very different than what you're thinking about. You're thinking about a primary.
No, I'm thinking about what happened with Gavin Newsom.
You really? I mean, the reason why Gavin Newsom had a recall was because they thought there was... There was, like, problems with
There was his something election. Other people were talking about with her betraying her constituents and them pretty much having no confidence in her whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I feel like there was some action that they wanted to take, but I didn't look too much into it.
I think the best action they could take is primarying her for the 2024 election.
That's in 3 years.
I know. It's ridiculous, but... I think primarying her in 2024 is the best option, because she's massively unpopular right now amongst not just her constituents, but obviously...
I think her approval rating dropped at least 40%.
Yeah, I mean, the only people she's really doing well with are conservatives, which is pretty bad considering you branded yourself as a progressive. If conservatives are the only group that seems to be liking you, you have done a terrible job. Maintaining your brand. Like,
honestly, I think she was only in it for the long term. Make her money and get out.
Probably. I mean,
and not even get out. She could even become probably one of the most successful lobbyists out there.
Oh, definitely. I could definitely see her, like, I definitely can see her using her government ties to get in with the wine industry, because, I mean, she has a winery. Like, she has a winery. And I think that is kind of where her passion lies, to be perfectly honest, with not just wine, but like that type of industry. It seems she's far more passionate about that than she is about her time as a senator, which would have been fine if she pursued that. But you're a United States senator. Not only do you represent the people of Arizona, your actions impact all 50 states and potentially the rest of the world. You need to take your job seriously. You cannot be this gaslight gatekeep girl boss where you're literally preventing people from getting survival wages. I mean, $15 minimum wage is great, but let's be honest here. Our current standard of living in this country, $15 is a survival wage. It's not livable, considering all the different things you gotta pay for in life.
Yeah, and just the way she carries herself in public, just... That is more of a slap in the face of it than anything else.
I definitely agree. And...
But going aside from the elevator incident, we should also definitely talk about the bathroom incident.
Yeah, so for those of you that don't know, Kyrsten Sinema, she was... I believe it was at...
It was at a university.
It was at a university. And a bunch of student activists were hammering her with questions about... Why are you the way that you are? Like, why haven't you been representing us? Why are you helping the gridlock in the Senate? Why didn't you go for $15 minimum wage? Why aren't you trying to raise the debt ceiling? Like, why aren't you trying to help immigrants? Like, why aren't you helping, like, you know, put more restrictions on ICE? Like, all these different things that her as a progressive would be supporting, she's not doing. And she ran into a women's restroom, and, I mean... Part of me thinks she did actually have to use the restroom, and they did catch her at a bad time, but she made no effort to really try and answer these questions, and so, Even if she did have to use the bathroom, it was definitely her hiding. She definitely just hid from them and just did not want to respond.
Yeah. Another one, I just remember this just now. Another incident came out either yesterday or the day before of two incidents at the airport on her way. I think it was on her way back to D.C.
Really? And it was people confronting her?
Yes. Once, I think it was once in the airplane and her walking out.
Damn. I mean, that just shows you right there that she's not doing well in terms of popularity.
Honestly, praise to these activists who aren't, like, absolutely livid in front of her.
Yeah.
Like, looking at her and not just freaking out. Like, a lot of these activists are really calm.
Yeah.
And
which I think is necessary.
Lots of praise to them, because I know it's not easy.
It's definitely not easy. And so it's definitely praise that they're staying calm, which I think, obviously, you should stay calm. I mean, you shouldn't lose your, you shouldn't lose your mind in front of, like, Congress people, because, I mean,
that just,
one, it doesn't look good optically, but two, are you really getting your point across if you're just screaming and raging?
Yeah, because, like, I'll use this as a metaphor. Like, it looks like, from a parent's point of view, it looks like a child whining for a nonsensical reason.
Yeah. Even if that reason is completely valid and the parent is a completely abusive person, if you're throwing a tantrum, you kind of lose the optical game.
Yeah. So I think they handled this extremely intelligently. And I think that we'll see more things like this in the future.
Yeah. And obviously, I feel like this goes without saying, but it still must be said. Criticism is not death threats or rape threats or any type of bigoted language. There are people that, unfortunately, do say these things about Kyrsten Sinema and really anybody in Congress or the Senate, and that's not appropriate, people. Yes, we disagree with them on a lot, but they are still people and they still deserve to be respected as such, meaning you shouldn't be giving her death threats or rape threats or any type of bigoted comments, because that doesn't accomplish anything and it's just morally wrong.
Overall, the actions we take represent who we are as people.
Yeah.
Like,
and do you really want yourself to be represented as someone that throws around death threats and rape threats when you have much more credible criticisms to someone like Kyrsten Sinema or Joe Manchin, who we're about to get into? Because, I mean, we have way more credible criticism. I mean, right now, the biggest thing that both of them are holding up is the debt ceiling, which, if you don't know what the debt ceiling, like the debt ceiling bill that's coming up is basically America needs to pay its bills. And to do that, we need to increase the debt ceiling to pay it off. If we don't pay it off, just as how if you did not pay your credit card bill, your credit score goes down, America's global credit score goes down. That means that corporations within the country are not seen as trustworthy to other countries. I mean, America as a whole, when it comes to paying back other countries, aren't seen as trustworthy. And government organizations within the country don't get paid, meaning that eventually a lot of them would lose funding and then they would start to break apart. So we really need this to get paid. I mean, you have to pay your bills because, I mean, your credit score is everything. Your credit score gets you a lot. It's the same thing with a country.
TLDR, them holding this back could make this economy implode.
Yeah. And so it's not good. And switching gears from Kyrsten Sinema, I want to look at Joe Manchin, because Kyrsten Sinema is not the only one. I mean, before Kyrsten Sinema, it was Joe Manchin. And Joe Manchin, he has a reputation as a blue dog Democrat, which, if you don't know what that means, is he's basically a Democrat that leans very conservatively.
And that hasn't even been a term used in the past, what do you think, half decade, decade?
I mean, it does still get thrown around in, like, political spheres, but it's definitely not Carmen Parlance anymore.
Right.
And so he is a blue dog Democrat, which makes sense.
Because he identifies himself as the moderate of the Democrats.
Yeah. Which, I mean, makes sense. I mean, he's from West Virginia, a red state, a very red state. And so a lot of his constituency is Republican and conservative. So it does make sense to a degree that that's how he's going to roll. But this level of obstruction that he is doing, and I think obstruction is the correct term to use because he's preventing things from being done within the Senate, I think is ludicrous.
And the biggest thing that he's doing right now is with the Build Back Better reconciliation bill is he is extremely flimsy on the target amount that he wants that bill to be. Because at first it was $6 trillion, and then it had to be negotiated down to $3.5 trillion, and now we're hearing rumors of $1.5
trillion. Yeah, I was going to say $1.5, which, oh my god, like, that's four times, that's like, $6 million is four times $1.5 million, right?
Or a quarter, yes.
Yeah, it's a quarter of it, that. And so, what are we doing? What are we doing, Joe? Like, honestly, why are you being so flimsy? Why are you holding us back? Is it because you're on a power trip right now? Because it seems like you've been like that ever since it was known that we were going to get majority in the Senate after the Georgia runoffs. You've been very, very much the only person that's really holding us back. I mean, especially on environmental issues. He's so deep in coal lobby pockets. It's as if you need a goddamn coal miner to dig him out. He's just so obstinate. And I get it. Republican constituency, coal mining, very big thing in West Virginia. Coal lobby, very powerful in Appalachia. I get it. But at some point, Joe, you need to actually stand up and have some principle. I mean, you need to save the people of your state. You know that coal mining is dangerous. You know it's not healthy. And you know that coal miners in this country are consistently and constantly getting screwed over by the coal industry. And now we have opportunities to move away from that so we're not putting people in danger. We can get better environmental, control and potentially find environmental alternatives. And you're stonewalling it. This will not help the people of West Virginia. You're killing them. Black lung is so common amongst coal miners that I believe it's that out of 100 miners that have black lung, only two of them will get any type of, recompense for any type of medical, needs that they need. Two in 100 coal miners. That is ridiculous, especially considering coal is very big. These are people. You are dealing with people's lives here. Well, people die from black lung.
The big reason, for sure, as I'm sure we all know, is that he's heavily invested in coal.
Yeah.
Like, why would, like, in his perspective, why would he help out the coal industry? Or not the coal industry.
He's coal miners.
Coal miners, like the workers in that industry. Why would he help them out?
I mean, yeah, it makes sense. And I mean, that's a problem when our public servants, which what senators are too involved with the bourgeoisie. Like, very, very wealthy corporate entities and aristocrats. This happens when our public servants feel more beholden to them than the people that they are supposed to be serving.
And going back to what you said earlier, this is being power hungry at its finest. Yeah. I wouldn't say Kyrsten Sinema is power hungry to the extent of Joe Manchin, which also is a question I want to toss around a bit too, is who do you think is worse right now?
I mean, I don't think it really matters, because even if Joe goes one way, if Kyrsten goes the other, we're still in the same situation. Or vice versa, if Kyrsten sides with the Democrats but Joe doesn't, we're still back at where we're still not getting anything done.
I guess the more apt question would be, who do you think you can turn easier?
Honestly, I feel that despite the fact that Joe Manchin is gambling with more people's lives, he is more likely to turn because he knows that if he doesn't play ball, he will be out. So he has to play ball somewhat. I feel like Kyrsten Sinema feels that she doesn't necessarily have to play ball, because even if she gets out by like 2024, she's had a 4-year stint in the Senate, which that goes a long way. That goes a long way for future endeavors.
Would it be 4 or 6 years?
I mean, wasn't she? Oh yeah, it's 6 years. I forgot. Senators go for 6 years. Duh. But yeah. So yeah, she would have had a 6-year stint in the Senate, which goes really far for future endeavors. So I feel like she doesn't need to play ball. But Joe Manchin, this man is a career politician.
Yeah.
Like, this man, for sure, in my opinion, will be more likely to play ball with Democrats. Yeah. Because, I mean, we see that. I mean, he did bring it down from $6 trillion to $1.5 trillion. Meanwhile, Kyrsten Sinema, her terms are what exactly?
I'm in the Senate.
Yeah. She hasn't even made her terms for what she would agree with. Publicly known, which I guess that really goes to show who's more willing to play ball.
Yeah. I did bring up a lot of instances with Kyrsten Sinema, but with Joe Manchin, there was one that did come up, and it was with activists kayaking to his yacht.
Yes, which, can you just imagine for a second the imagery? Just, this is a man who's a public servant.
He's talking down to the people.
He's on a yacht. And the way that people can get to him to get their voices heard is to kayak to his yacht. In ye olden days, this is the equivalent of poor paupers having to painstakingly make their way to the castle, get vetted by the arbitrary standards of whoever is vetting, to finally get an audience with whatever lord that is there, to have their 5 seconds, and then get shooed away and then probably beaten by the guards in the back.
Yeah, at least we don't have to worry about that right now.
I mean, we don't, but I mean, it's the same type of thing that's happening now. You shouldn't have to kayak to a senator's yacht to make your voices heard. That is absurd. And that really is telling about the current state of things in politics, where many politicians, both Democrat and Republican, are so far removed from the people they represent that you have to corner them in bathrooms or kayak to them to get them to even listen to you. Not even get them to do something, but just listen to you. I think that is really sad. It's really disheartening. And I think it's really just disgusting. I think it needs to stop. And obviously it's not going to, just because I said it should, but It really does need to stop, because these are people's lives, especially because we're in the COVID-19 pandemic. The world has fundamentally changed as a result of this pandemic, and people need aid more than ever. And what do we have?
Honestly, I'm going to just say, I think their actions of stonewalling this whole endeavor is going to be the reason we lose both the House and the Senate come next year.
You really think we'll lose the House because of them?
We lost many seats in the House last year.
I mean, we did lose them last year, but I mean, it does matter what the House does this year. So we can maintain the House, because I mean, remember, we were able to get the Senate down as much as we did because the Republican senators were that bad at their job.
That is true.
So long as the Democrats don't perform as bad and can at least bring some type of marginal improvement to the populace, I think at least the House can maintain something. The Senate, on the other hand, that's tough. Because amongst Republicans, really at this point, if you're a Republican that likes the current Republican Party in the Senate, nothing's really going to change your mind.
Like, are there really any unpopular Republican senators amongst that party?
Ted Cruz. Because Ted Cruz is always unpopular and no one likes him.
True.
I mean, you saw during, what was it, January 6th, where Lindsey Graham, unprompted, when talking about January 6th, just started shitting all over Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
He was like, I don't agree with Ted Cruz. I mean, when Rand Paul and I agree about something, you know it's crazy or something like that. I mean, they don't like him. No one likes Ted Cruz.
But do you think he's going to be voted out?
Oh, obviously not. But it's less because it's more because he has his own little cult down in Texas that will love him despite the fact that he abandoned them in the middle of a snowstorm that took out their power grid. But that's neither here nor there. But
I mean, of Republicans, the main one that's just not popular is Ted Cruz. But even then, I mean, the people that don't like Ted Cruz aren't in the state, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the reality of it.
All right. Well, we actually went way over time, but we intended this show to be an hour. Yeah. But we will go to an hour and a half to cover our last segment, which happens to cover the Pandora Papers.
Yeah. So Pandora Papers is a journalistic compendium of financial documents. And it
really serves as like the sequel to the Panama Papers.
Yeah. If you don't know what the Panama Papers were, the Panama Papers was a gigantic, investigative journaling endeavor where numerous financial documents and information about banking and secret funds and shell companies and all those different things were revealed to the public that many rich and powerful people across the globe were doing.
And really, like, it was massive. I think it was like over 2.5 terabytes of data that was leaked.
Yeah, which is massive. And you had politicians, obviously, corporate owners, but you even had famous celebrities like Emma Watson named in the Panama Papers. It was that big. And so now with the Pandora Papers being the sequel, we're seeing not necessarily the same level as the Panama Papers. It's not as massive, but still pretty big, with this one being firmly centered around foreign leaders, mainly the big ones being King Abdullah II of Jordan, former Prime Minister of the UK, Tony Blair.
You also have people with connections to Vladimir Putin.
Oh, yes. Vladimir Putin's affair partner. You also have, some American CEOs. I know there was one that's a very big corporate donor to the DNC and another to the RNC. But I would say this is mainly a foreign. You would agree that this is mainly about foreign.
I mean, even the Panama Papers was mostly foreign, if I would recall.
Yeah. So this is also just to show that the corruption that we see in this country isn't just localized to America. It is a problem across the globe. Do you want to go a little bit more about the biggest things that came out of it?
Well, before, I think we should address like what exactly is happening, why these are, like, what is going on that is so morally reprehensible.
Okay,
due to our limited time.
Yeah.
But because the big thing is people shelling all their money offshore, off to low tax countries. Of course, the Panama Papers had to deal with people hiring a law firm over in Panama to keep all of their assets. And that's really what's going on here again, is we're getting a whole bunch of looks into people's financial records and seeing what's really going on.
Yeah. I mean, this time it's, I know one of the biggest areas that was shown this time was the British Virgin Islands, which is a territory. Yeah. So,
because last time it was just Panama and the Cayman Islands.
Yeah, this one is like British Virgin Islands, and it was several other, while you give a little bit more detail, I'll get a list of some of the countries that were implicated this time.
Yeah. The one that comes to mind that I brought up earlier was the one with Putin's alleged affair partner. Yeah. I believe like she was given like several, like, I wouldn't even say houses.
Would it properties?
I think at the very least properties that have been revealed. Because, I mean, he appeared in both papers at this point.
Yeah. Actually, it was 2.9 terabytes for this one.
Really? So this one was bigger.
Yeah, this one's actually bigger. So I was wrong. It is bigger than the Panama paper by, 2.6 terabytes. And, oh my God. The amount of money we're talking about is 5.6 trillion USD to 32 trillion. $32 trillion. That is an unfathomably high amount of money. And that's what we're talking across these documents. So much money that could be used to better people, especially the citizenry of all these countries.
Because one of the biggest motivations, maybe not the biggest, but the biggest, one of the biggest ones of all, is just avoiding taxes.
Yeah.
Like, there are some uses, like keeping business secrets and things of that nature, but really like corporations are doing this to keep money out of paying to their domestic to where their corporations reside domestically.
Yeah.
And that's money that is not put into the population and could be helping them out.
Yeah, it's really crazy. I mean, one of, and I mean, it's just any rich and powerful person, really. Like, you have world leaders, you have religious figures, you have bankers, ministers, you even have a convicted murderer in Robert Durst being called out in this paper. It's like, it's a, just corruption top to bottom. And it's not just the fact that it's just like, you know, corrupt people like politicians. These people use this money and funnel them through terrorist organizations and organized crime organizations, meaning that the harm being done in hoarding this money is not just, oh, we're withholding money that we could use to the people. We're also helping and enabling people that commit crimes such as murder, kidnapping, trafficking, extortion. Just so many different crimes are being, you know, being allowed to go by because these rich people want to completely hide their wealth. Yeah. For what reason? I mean, you're so rich. You're so rich to the point where you probably can't spend all your money in your lifetime. Why must you hoard it even more? Like, what do you gain? Like Abdullah II, you're the king of Jordan. You're a king. What more could you need? What more wealth could you need to hoard as one of the most powerful people in your country?
Yeah. And because of how of the nature of how new this story is, I'm sure we'll learn a lot more as the week develops. For sure.
Absolutely. The thing that definitely intrigues me the most about this is the ties to organized crime, more than anything. Because it's known that many corrupt politicians, business people, bankers, religious affiliates, they all have their hands in organized crime. And to see that these people not only turn a blind eye to organized crime or only minorly profit from organized crime by virtue of organized crime being able to purport certain businesses that then they can invest in, but straight up just funneling money through the organized crime to hoard their own money, I think is, I mean, it's already reprehensible, but that just makes it even more reprehensible. These are the same people that will go around and talk about how they believe in law and order and that they believe in the greatness of their country and how all these different things, but then they'll turn around and they will help fund organizations and groups of people that not only seek to do harm to the people within their country, but their neighbors and the world over.
What saddens me the most is, like the Panama Papers, we're probably going to get zero consequences out of this whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully this time around, we haven't been, at least to my knowledge, we haven't been given some type of chief author.
Which right, is, this was a collaboration between 600 different journalists. Like, I think because there were implications of the last one with the fact that the head author was car-bombed.
Yeah, the head author of the Panama Papers was car-bombed in 2017. It was definitely because of her part in producing these papers. She was assassinated. Like, let's not mince words here. It was an assassination. She was killed because she exposed the rich and powerful for what they were, and they killed her for it. And so I really hope this time we don't see that happen.
Which, the fact that there's not a head author is probably a sign for the best, and bless these authors for being brave and coming out, or the journalists for coming out with this information. But the sad part is we're probably not going to get anything about or get any consequences from this that would positively impact society.
Yeah.
But it is important that we know this information, because it is important that we know about stuff like this, because us being kept in the dark only hurts us.
Yeah. I mean, this should serve... I mean, there's been numerous wake-up calls throughout the past couple of years, but this should serve as another wake-up call that the rich and powerful in this country really don't care about us. They don't care about us, the people, insofar as how much money we can make for them. And we need to fight back against that. We need to fight back against these
politicians, corporate owners, religious heads, all these different people, we need to fight against them. And no, I don't necessarily mean fight as in physically go out and fight them and beat them. No, you will die doing that. Please do not do that. But we need to strike more. We need to go on strike. We need to, like this labor shortage currently. We're going through a labor shortage here in the United States, and it's for good reason. The conditions that workers have in this country are abysmal. And we're finally seeing pushback. We're finally seeing the workers of the United States say, you know what? We don't need to tolerate this. We deserve better. And I think this should serve to really show that we need to be doing this everywhere. And I mean, we have been doing it everywhere. There are activists all across the country, especially within the third world, that have been championing efforts to really point this out. But we need to do this more. We need to support the strike efforts that are going on currently and other future strike efforts, and not just in our own countries, but abroad, as this is a global thing. Like, while we get pushed against each other all the time with different forms of culture war things, or different, like, oh, like, we must fear North Korea, the Russians, whatever, the main thing we should be fearing are the powerful people of those countries. Your average citizen of America, Canada, Russia, China, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, Kenya, whatever, your average layperson in those countries is not your enemy. They are more alike to you than the rich and powerful of your own country. And we need to, as a collective, be able to really fight back against this corruption. We need to hold these people to task. And obviously, these people are probably not going to be shown any type of legal consequence whatsoever. But just the fact that we're exposing them, and by we, I mean people that are not them, that are exposing them to the world, I think is a good step forward and something that we should encourage even more. I mean, we saw what happened with the Facebook whistleblower that happened earlier this week, where she completely blew the lid about how Facebook uses its algorithm to radicalize people with fake information to the point where world leaders are fixing their policy positions to match the propaganda that is being pushed by Facebook. We're literally seeing rich and powerful people like Mark Zuckerberg drive political discourse across the world for profit, and it's not for the benefit of people. I mean, there's a massacre going on in, what is, Malaysia, I believe?
I'm actually not aware of that.
I believe it's a massacre of the Muslim population by a primarily Buddhist population in Malaysia. And that's being coordinated by Facebook. It's being coordinated across Facebook. Why? Why is someone like Mark Zuckerberg allowed to let that slide on his platform? Why is he allowed to get billions upon billions of dollars for helping, basically, platforming, like, genocide apologia? Why is he allowed to do that? And then in the same vein, why are we allowing world leaders and former world leaders to profit and hide their profits from the people that they either serve or once served? Because those profits might as well be going to the deaths of people around the world, because they ain't going to help us. That's for damn sure.
Well, at that point, that leaves us over the hour 25-minute mark, which definitely a good sign for the future that we went over our estimated time.
Oh, for sure. I definitely can see us talking, especially with other topics. I think we can go for much longer, but this was just a pilot episode, and we hope to do this for a lot longer. This was really fun.
Yeah. I know one segment we've got planned for next week is our thoughts and opinions on Venom, Let There Be Carnage, which we'll be giving our initial thoughts and probably a retrospective on the original Venom movie with next week's showing.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, I mean, I feel like we could probably talk more about Facebook next week, but we also need to see what the news cycle brings us, because there's a big thing happening every day, pretty much.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the Facebook thing broke. I mean, Facebook went down yesterday. Was it yesterday or the day before?
I believe it was the day.
I think it was the day
before. It was the day before, I remember, because I was stuck at the DMV. Not the DMV, the dealership.
Yeah, and that was the same day that the whistle... Was it the same day, actually?
Yeah, it was the same day. The same day. The Panama Papers dropped, Facebook went down, and the whistleblower, her full 60 Minutes interview had finally gone worldwide trending.
Yeah.
All happened on the same day. And on one hand, that is phenomenal. That is the perfect storm of really showing you that... The rich and powerful in this country, and not just this country, the world, are corrupt, and they are literally playing with the lives of people. But it's also a showing of just, God, just how messed up things are.
Well, looks like I lied. Looks like we're doing two segments planned for next week.
I mean, obviously we're going to have more than two next week. These are just the main two that we know we're going to do.
I mean, we did four today, so of course. And we only expected that to last an hour.
Yeah.
But we'll definitely be doing this weekly. We'll be doing this 7 p.m. EST, 4 p.m. Pacific. So definitely catch us every Wednesday.
Yep. Today's the 6th. I know that some people are rumoring that a Pokemon trailer for Brilliant Diamond Shining Pearl comes out on Friday. So if it does, you'll definitely catch us here giving our thoughts about that.
Definitely, definitely.
We could probably also talk about a Nickelodeon All-Star Brawl.
That would be fun, especially after our discussion of Smash.
Yeah, I mean, this is purported the certified Smash killer. Will it go the route of Temtem, which was supposed to be the Pokemon killer? Who knows? But we definitely have a lot to talk about next week, so I hope you guys tune back in.
Yeah, definitely.
This is Shiny.
And Sovereign.
And this is Worldwide Wednesday, and I hope you guys have a great evening.
All right. See you guys later.